music from Anton Webern, a Viennese man just demonstrating some of the intensely felt angst from the early 20th century as we go to this city that is a great favourite with travellers, Australian and otherwise. Maybe it should feature much higher, though, in our hierarchy of recognition, as nothing less, my last guest today will suggest, than the city of the 20th century, Vienna. Richard Cockett is a British writer and historian who captivated me with a piece in The Economist's special Christmas edition about Vienna's impact on so many issues that have preoccupied us in the last 30 years or so. If you want disruption, Vienna will give it to you in spades at the end of the 19th century, he'd say, offering context to today's shifts which so perturb us. The cultural upheavals, the intense intellectual movements were not limited to the Austrian capital, but the Viennese rebellion, he says, was more intense and more wide-ranging, and it provoked a more extreme reaction. Vienna was thus the cradle of modernism and fascism, liberalism and totalitarianism, the currents that have shaped much of Western thought and politics since Vienna itself started to implode in 1916 right up to the present day. It has been, says Richard Cockett, the Viennese century. Yes, there's that dispiriting word implode, which may be a pointer we need to be alert to, especially given some of the discussions we've been having thus far on the program. I'll take that up with Richard. Welcome to Saturday Extra.
Hello. Welcome. Yeah, thank you.
So all this fevered innovation, all these new thoughts, these new people that you write about, it did implode, did it? We have to sort of have that as a corrective in our discussion?
Yes. I think the golden age of Viennese culture and thought is usually taken from about 1890 to the death of the by then very aged emperor, Franz Joseph, and in 1916. And 2 years later, Austria was defeated at the end of the First World War, and the Austro-Hungarian Empire collapsed to be replaced by a republic. There was a brief afterlife in the 1920s, but then fascism and eventually Nazism took over in the 1930s, and then Austria ceased to function as an independent country entirely with the Anschluss when Hitler invaded Austria in 1938. But the golden age, I think, everyone accepts is about 1890 to 1920.
So, I mean, do you feel it was all too much too fast? Is that what you're implying?
I think what I'm implying is, I mean, it was a unique combination of events that produced this extraordinary, rich culture of academic pursuits, intellectualism, art, culture, et cetera, et cetera. In every field, for about 15 years, 20 years, Viennese were the main. Only Berlin really rivaled Vienna in this sense. But I would argue that the Viennese revolutions were more intense and more long-lasting. But I also argue that, you know, this great explosion of what we could call liberal, progressive thought produced its exact opposite, because Vienna not only was the home of Wittgenstein and Gustav Mahler, Egon Schiele, lots of other well-known names, it was also where Hitler grew up, Adolf Hitler, and he learnt his fascism and particularly his anti-Semitism in the Vienna of that period. So it produced both much that is best, most memorable, most progressive and most influential in Western thought, culture and politics. And it also produced as a reaction against that, all that is darkest and most aggressive and most bleak in Western thought and culture too. And that's the significance of Vienna. No other city has ever produced such opposite extremes in so short a time.
Yes, yeah, see, I think a lot of people listening might have imagined that to be Berlin's story. But of course, as various people have been pointing out, Berlin was actually a very working class place. And Hitler didn't like Berlin at all. So you're saying it didn't have those extremes, actually?
Well, in the end, Adolf Hitler was Austrian. He was born in Linz. And the precursors, the first really modern anti-Semitic politician was the mayor of Vienna at the turn of the century, a man called Karl Luger. There is still a statue to him in Vienna today. And Hitler really modeled his politics on Karl Luger. Karl Luger was his hero. as well as one or two other Austrian anti-Semitic politicians, but Karl Weger above all. And it was really Hitler learnt his politics, his anti-Semitism, and also how to mobilize nationalism in the Vienna before the First World War. And Hitler, like many other Viennese, went very enthusiastically to war in 1914 in defense of the German-speaking peoples and the Austro-Hungarian Empire, the Habsburg Empire. Mm.
The stories of the Jews of Vienna is particularly poignant. Maybe you could sketch their status for us, because they were great citizens of Vienna, and they thought they were safe, I think.
Yes, that's right. You know, Vienna was a center of Jewish culture during that period. And by Jewish culture, I mean really the whole range of Jewish culture, from very assimilated Jews, so Jews who barely regarded themselves as Jews, but regarded themselves essentially as members of high German culture, secular German culture, people who'd left their Jewish roots way behind. There were those, and all the way through to very observant Jews, more recent arrivals perhaps. So it was a real mixture. But as in Germany and Berlin, a lot of the Jews really did feel that they shouldn't be regarded as Jews, and indeed, in retrospect, came to be very wary of being stamped as Jews, even after the Anschluss and after Hitler had taken over. It became a very sensitive subject for people like Ernest Gombrich, for instance, the famous art historian. In retrospect, people tried to interpret Viennese culture during that period, 1819 to 1914, as a particularly Jewish culture or a non-Jewish culture or racial mix of cultures. And people like Gombrich insisted that's never how we regarded ourselves. We were Germans. We spoke German and we were a member of German culture. And to brand us as Jews is to use the language of the enemy. So it was a very complex mix. But there's no doubt that Hitler, of course, and others identified Jews as being particularly alien to the culture of the time.
Did they have full citizenship, by the way?
They didn't have full citizenship, but they had as many rights, really, as anywhere else in Europe. So they were almost fully accepted as full members of the empire. Mm. And that's why, you know, that's partly why so many of them came there, because it was a remarkably tolerant and liberal place in an era when, you know, casual anti-Semitism was prevalent in Europe. And at the same time, for instance, as France was having the Dreyfus Affair, where, you know, a Jewish officer was accused of spying for foreign powers, and this started the first great anti-Semitic movement in France. But in Vienna, they felt safe. They felt at home with a lot of like-minded people. And that's why really the destruction of that, the rise of Hitler, came as such a shock. They were completely unprepared for this, really, because they'd felt so at home, so at ease, at a culture which they had helped to form.
Maybe you could just give us very quickly a sketch of some of the great characters and their range and sweep of talents.
Well, where to begin? I mean, there was the famous philosopher Ludwig Wittgenstein. Wittgenstein, who wrote one of the famous works of 20th century philosophy, the Logica Tractatus Philosophicus, he was a member, a scion of one of the huge, big Jewish families of Vienna, the Wittgensteins. His father was immensely wealthy industrialist. And the Wittgensteins were also represented some other aspects of Viennese culture. There was a sort of extraordinary seriousness and a high-mindedness about these people. These people were very intent in their purpose of changing the world and in improving mankind. Three of Wittgenstein's brothers committed suicide.
Well, yes, I was going to come to that. There was always this ghastly sort of... Yeah. The freedom had came at a price, as you point out. The young Viennese put such huge demands on themselves. Several of them committed suicide as they fell short of their own high standards.
Yes. That's right, yes. And somebody called it once the laboratory of self-destruction, which was a good phrase for it at this time, because they were pushing the boundaries in all fields here, physics, philosophy,
Freud,
mathematics. Freud, yes, exactly. Psychoanalysis, art, culture, music, Mahler, Schoenberg, etc. The beginnings of eternal music. And of course, you know, in this kind of fevered intellectual atmosphere, there were a lot of casualties. Mm. And of course, everyone was hitting, was setting very, very high standards for intellectual achievement. And, you know, many fell short of those standards and would feel unworthy. And many took their own lives as a result.
What about the long tail effect of this? I don't know whether it's a cautionary tale. Why do you call it the Viennese century? Is it because of what occurred, where all those talents went?
Yes. I mean, fascism and Hitler, particularly the Anschluss of 1938, drove most of the thinkers out of, and artists out of Vienna, both Jews and non-Jews, because it was clear that Vienna would no longer be the tolerant liberal place for anyone after the 1930s. Many of them went to Britain and many of them went to America. And together, I argue that they launched, you know, a similar intellectual revolution in the Western world. And you can trace the roots of so much of modern Western culture, which we regard as British or American culture, to these émigrés. I mean, they had enormous effect on politics, political economy, writing, structured finance. They helped launch the internet. You know, everywhere you look, they were innovating. And so I think they had probably more impact per head than any other diaspora in modern history. So that's why I call it the Viennese century.
Can you still feel it there? When I went years ago, I thought it was very sort of somewhat antiseptic, I've got to say, and sort of...
No, I mean, but you're absolutely right. And when you go, it's a city of ghosts, Vienna, because all this was ruthlessly stamped out in the 1930s. As we know, the Nazis were nothing if not thorough. And they did a very good job of completely eradicating this culture. And very little of it came back after the war. So there is very, it's a historian's town. You know, you can see the buildings and, you know, people, there are historians there who will treasure this. But the story is relatively unknown in Vienna, which the Viennese essentially now see themselves as the city of Mozart, the city of the Habsburgs, the city of waltzes, etc. But, you know, this story is darker, it's more complicated, the one I'm telling, and many Viennese shy away from that as a result. But it's far more significant, I would argue, for contemporary thought and modern politics.
Thank you very much indeed for telling us.
My pleasure.
Richard.
And good luck on your next journey to Vienna.
Yes, I'll try to find some of what you've been describing, even in ghostly form. Thanks, Richard. Richard is a historian and a regional editor with The Economist. His piece on Vienna was in the magazine's 2016 Christmas edition, which was really very engaging. I read it on a plane. Here's a little more from the Viennese composer and conductor Anton Webern. Interestingly, his music was denounced as cultural Bolshevism and degenerate art by the Nazi Party, so you get a general drift. Here's a second movement of Opus 5 for strings. Webern. My thanks to Andy Ford, actually, from the music show, for suggesting that as a beautiful encapsulation of what we've just been describing. And I'd very much welcome your thoughts if you've been a traveller to Vienna and the gorgeous Ringstrasse. There's all sorts of gorgeous things to do there. It's just not quite what it was, as you've heard. So I'd be very keen to hear from you.